Russian troops enter a major city in the northeast of Ukraine as blasts are heard in the capital Kiev on the fourth day of the conflict. Meantime, the Ukrainian president refuses to hold talks with Moscow and neighboring Belarus, where a Russian delegation has arrived. Iran's top diplomat says if the U.S. had the option of a dignified withdrawal from Afghanistan, it would have done so. I'm Behruz Najafi. Welcome. Moscow's military operation in Ukraine now on its fourth day. The Kremlin saying that Russian troops have already entered Kharkiv, a city in the northeast. The Russian military also claims to have entirely besieged the cities of Kherson in the south and Berdyansk in the southeast. Meanwhile, a series of blasts have been heard west of the Ukrainian capital Kiev center on Sunday, minutes after air raid sirens sounded. Ukrainian media has also reported explosions and a gunfight in a nearby town. Fighting is reportedly underway in the town of Bucha, west of Kiev. And this, as President Volodymyr Zelensky says, that Ukraine's military is in control of the capital.
I am here. We will not lay down the weapons. We will defend our state because our weapon is our truth. And the truth is that this is our land, our country, our children, and we will defend all of that.
Zelensky has reportedly turned down a U.S. offer to evacuate him from Kiev, noting that he needs ammunition, not a ride. The health ministry says 198 people, including three children, have been killed since fighting began on Thursday. Kiev also claims more than 1,000 Russian soldiers have been killed, although Moscow has not released any figure. Russia says it has targeted Ukraine's military infrastructure with air and sea-based cruise missiles, destroying some 800 targets. Moscow has denied reports of targeting cities. It says it's taken required measures to avoid civilian casualties. Around 115,000 Ukrainians have already crossed into Poland. Now, meanwhile, a Russian delegation has arrived in Belarus for talks with Ukrainian authorities. President Volodymyr Zelensky says that he remains open to talks in locations that, in his words, show no aggression toward Ukraine. The president says that Ukraine is only ready for real talks and that if it won't accept any conditions or ultimatums. He believes that negotiations in Minsk could have been possible if Russia had not attacked Ukraine. His advisor has also weighed in, describing the Russian team's trip to Belarus as pointless. Okay, now allow me to invite two guests to this special coverage of the Ukraine issue. So joining me will be John Stepling, author and commentator in Indre, Norway. Also Andrew Leung, independent political analyst, is joining us out of Hong Kong. Now, John, tell us what's going on in Ukraine. How do you look at the situation?
Well, I mean, not much differently than the other day when we spoke about it. I'm hearing echoes here, so it's very hard to fix that. The Russian military is doing pretty much what Putin said they were going to do, which was to sort of surgically remove the Nazi elements from the Ukrainian military, which is probably most of the military. And what we're going to end up with is a kind of frontier region in which Donbass is protected. I mean, the story here really is about Western media coverage and the extraordinary bias and propaganda coming out of the West. There is almost no mention of the shelling of Donbass for the last few years. 14,000 Russians were killed, civilians were killed in Donbass. Putin's actions really were driven by that more than anything else, I think. But of course, it is the U.S.-NATO eastward expansion, that the U.S.-NATO military infrastructure has continued to move ever closer to Russia, culminating in Ukraine, which has something like 2,000-kilometer border with Russia, And that's just, you know, that's a completely unacceptable position for any country to be put in. I can't imagine anybody would tolerate the massive military buildup on its border from what is perceived as a kind of hostile force, which is U.S. NATO. And there's certainly a track record for that. I mean, I was thinking today about the Cuban Missile Crisis. The U.S. wasn't terribly happy with Soviet missiles in an island off its coast. Well, Russia's not terribly happy either with this U.S.-NATO buildup throughout the region, because it's not just Ukraine. I mean, we're talking about Romania, Bulgaria, Estonia, Latvia, and Poland, certainly. This was all in violation of a promise that James Baker made to Gorbachev, is well known. So I think the situation is that Russia wants to secure the safety of its people in Donbass, and to eliminate, you know, the Azov battalion and the Nazi elements that were doing the shelling of Donbass. And the U.S., of course, knew that was going to happen. They armed this Nazi faction, this far-right party, and they armed them. They knew this was going to happen. This was provocation. They're not that stupid. And of course, it did happen. All those new weapons, these, you know, knuckle-dragging Nazis are going to use those weapons. But the coverage doesn't the Western coverage of this includes none of this. It's all seen as an unprovoked invasion by the Russian military, and that they're going to be slaughtering Ukrainians or something. It's all just nonsense. And Zelensky, I mean, you know, this is a guy who's a former stand-up comedian. That's the kind of gravitas he projects. It's comical if it weren't tragic.
Okay.
That's the reality.
Okay. Now, let's turn to Hong Kong and see how Andrew Ling looks at this, and what caused all this, and what's the way out of this? Because Russian delegation is there in Belarus, but Zelensky says he's not going there.
There's two main issues there. First of all, what has caused this? And secondly, as you said, what's the likely outcome? Now, I think this is a long time coming. I think that President Putin must have done his sums for a long, long time, choosing this particular moment to intervene. Because as far as President Putin is concerned, I mean, hero is in fact Peter the Great, the old Russian Empire, the USSR. And he wants to wind back history to the time when Russia, the former USSR, was protected by its near abroad, all these so-called satellite states, would act as a buffer zone. But now, with the collapse of the former USSR, and according to Putin, it was the greatest disaster in Russian history, and Russia became weaker and weaker, and was seen to be under the thumb of the West. But now, Russia has become much stronger militarily, and to a certain extent, relying on energy, is economically stronger than before. And now, at a time when the United States hegemony seems to be in decline, the moment is well chosen. And I think that also the good reason is that there are Russian natives, Russian people in Donbass, almost as many as 700, to protect the R2P. That principle was used in the intervention of Kosovo several decades ago by NATO against Kosovo. So it is now paying the West back with their own rhetoric. So I think that the first solution is to minimize the kind of casualties and to cause a regime change in Ukraine. It's not just Donbass, and obviously Ukraine is, of course, is about twice as big as Germany. So it's a big country. There is no way that Russia wants to be bogged down in Ukraine. So the likely outcome, and hence this negotiations held out in Paris, and forcing the Ukraine government to negotiate in terms, obviously, Russia wants, is really for the current presidency to step down and in favor of a more Russian friendly replacement. And in fact, the replacement is already in place. And so I think that would be the ideal solution, because that, in a way, what Russia wants is a buffer zone in Ukraine, being such a big, big country. So there was a lot of rhetoric about Russia wanting to conquer the entire Europe. I think that this is really overhyped.
Okay, thanks for that. John Stepelink, author and commentator from Enjoy, and Andrew Leung, independent political analyst from Hong Kong. I thank them for their contribution and input. Let's move on with the rest of this broadcast. Hundreds of Palestinian schoolchildren have gathered near a village in the occupied West Bank to make their voices heard against Israeli restrictions preventing them from going to school. The protest happened at the entrance to Laban al-Sharqiya village in Nablus. The demonstrators held signs and waved Palestinian flags, urging UNESCO to intervene. Regime forces used tear gas to disperse the protesters, injuring several of them. This is the fourth consecutive week that protests are held against the restrictions. Regime troops have resorted to using force, often firing sound bombs and rubber bullets to disperse the crowd. They accused the students of throwing rocks at Israeli settlers. The village is home to some 3,500 Palestinians, but Israel is using their land to build settler units. Well, Tehran says that Washington sometimes sends messages that contradict the reality on the ground. Now, Amir Abdullahi made comments in an exclusive interview with Press of his Inside program. The top diplomat said that if Washington had had the option of pulling out its troops from Afghanistan in a more dignified manner, it would have done so without disgracing itself. Now, Iranian MPs are reviewing the specifics of the budget bill proposed by the government. The parliament says it will not tie the final bill to the results of the Vienna talks on the revival of the 2015 deal. Yusuf Jalali has a report.
Iran's parliament is reviewing the details of the budget bill for the next fiscal year, starting on March 21st. The government's proposed budget stands at roughly $148 billion, some 4% higher than last year's approved budget. Lawmakers have earlier approved the generalities of the budget bill, and it's been a week now since examination of the bill kicked off in parliament's open sessions.
The government's cap on next year's budget is roughly $148 billion. Out of this figure, $60 billion is allocated for the general budget and $88 billion is earmarked for government spending. Parliament is making some revisions, especially in national development projects and infrastructure. We increased the allocated budget in these areas.
This time, the budget's examination process took longer due to the fact that lawmakers want to be as meticulous as possible while evaluating the income and spending in the country.
While Iran and the P4 Plus One are engaged in tough negotiations in Vienna over the revival of the 2015 deal, President Ebrahim Raisi says the budget bill seeks to promote a resistance economy that would not need to wait for the removal of U.S. sanctions.
Parliament says the budget bill was drawn up based on a no-deal possibility in the Vienna talks and the continuation of U.S. sanctions on Iran.
The proposed budget expects the country's oil sales to reach 1.2 million barrels per day, with $60 a barrel, which would earn Iran some $14 billion in the fiscal year 2022-23. Lawmakers reset this figure to 1.4 million BPDs, with $70 a barrel. Any agreement in the ongoing Vienna talks will immediately push Iran's oil sales up by at least 500,000 BPDs as a result of the removal of U.S. oil embargoes on Iran. But lawmakers say they will not wait for the fate of the negotiations to finalize the budget bill, saying any extra petrodollar will be spent for the good of the people.
We cannot waste our time and wait if the U.S. removes the sanctions or not. So we set the budget based on a daily export of 1.4 million barrels of oil through direct or barter sales and based on assumptions that oil prices will hover around $70, when in fact the prices are reaching $100. Any extra oil income will be saved in a national development fund.
President Ebrahim Raisi submitted the budget bill to Parliament in mid-December last year, when Parliament approved its general outlines. Lawmakers now have 3 weeks to go over the details and fix the shortcomings of the budget, to pass it into law, before handing it to the higher legislative body, the Constitutional Council, for final approval. Yusuf Jalali, Tehran.
That's a wrap for this edition.
Our voice comes from the heart of beautiful Iran.
Aperture. Welcome back to Aperture. We witnessed the spectacular and awe-inspiring natural beauty of the Kaluts, or Yardangs, in the western part of Dasht-e-Lut in Iran. Rising up to 80 meters, these streamlined ridges have been carved by the wind out of the clay and sand lining the desert floor, creating a magnificent array of high-rising sculptures and lying parallel to the prevailing winds. The Yardangs are some of the world's most prominent. Stay with us as we follow Javad Gharayi, an Iranian nature explorer and documentary filmmaker, as he introduces more of Iran's desert wonders to us.
Early the next morning, I was still sleepy and tired, but some of the most beautiful natural views revealed themselves in the moments before sunrise. The cold and the dark couldn't stop me from exploring the natural beauties near my camp. The early hours of morning in the natural world fills you with energy. Filled to the brim with that energy that emanates from the peace and tranquility bestowed upon this land by God Almighty, I started my day that promised to be a good one. I spent 3 hours exploring the areas around my tent, taking beautiful photos of the unmatched scenery of the Kaluts, a precious gift by Mother Nature to those who appreciate her. It was time for me to leave the imaginary city of Kaluts, a city with great potential for becoming a destination for responsible tourists and nature travelers. The most beautiful natural scenes should either be visited in the early hours of morning or sometime around sundown. I got up at 6 o'clock this morning and was able to take spectacular snaps of the natural beauties around here with this very camera. I have to say, I love Iran with all my being because of its very rich culture and its remarkably diverse natural beauties. It's time to go now. I have to pack up. I gotta put my tent back into my backpack and head out for the Kalutz again. This is my last day here. I can't stay here much longer because I'm running out of food and water. Not only the Kalutz, but the entire vast Lut region are considered as an invaluable natural museum in the world. All by itself, the Lut Desert is home to a world of numerous beauties, the like of which are scattered in different places across our planet. Without a doubt, it's among the most beautiful deserts on Earth. The Yalon mega dunes with their rare views, the Kalutz, the star-shaped dunes, the beautiful valleys in the heart of Lut, the hottest part of Dashtalut, which is Gandum Merian, a large plateau covered in dark lava, the unique vegetation, including small trees named Saxols, the Martian or miniature mountains on the fringes of Lut, the central hole, the Dolphin Valley comprised of rock formations eroded by wind, Dashtakashk, and the plant and animal species endemic to Lut. Add to all that the villages with their unique desert architecture, people whose cultures go back 6,000 years. My GPS is telling me I've walked around 36 kilometers through the Kalutz. This is nearly the end of my trek into the Kalutz. Another very beautiful feature of the Kalutz of Kerman, in other words, the Kalutz of Shahdad, is the Nepka Forest Park. These very beautiful plants you see behind me here are in fact the trees that have formed this Nepka Forest Park. Only two species, salt cedars and saxols, which have grown here and created this beautiful and unique landscape. This area obviously looks different from others. The Nepka's Forest Park forms the vegetation on the fringe of the Kalut area. But this green patch fades away as you move from the cold mountains of Sirj to the hot, dry Kalutz. And in the heart of the Kalutz, there is hardly any vegetation at all. But Mother Nature has created a matchless forest in the area between the Sirj Mountains and the Kalutz. This strange land formation I'm standing next to is not your simple hill. It is the world's biggest natural vase known as the Nepka. This phenomenon is called Nepka in the African Sahara, Shur Moro in the central areas of Iran, and Talagaz by those living on the eastern and southeastern plains of Iran. When sandstorms blow past the vegetation in this area, they leave behind some of the dirt and sand at the foot of these plants. When the wind blows, some of the sand and dirt is trapped in the trees and crashes to the ground, creating a mound over time. In order to survive, the trees use their long roots to absorb water and other nutrients buried underground. The dirt around the shrubs and trees contain more moisture. This relative moisture keeps the sand and earth in place around the plant. Of course, that leads to a portion of the trunk, branches, and leaves being buried, which in turn contributes to the solidification of the sand near the plant. Every natural Nepka vase is named according to the species it hosts. The Nepkas are called Talagaz or Talitar by the locals in this region. Another unique feature of Lut are these same Nepkas. They are the tallest natural vases in the world. The Nepkas of this kind have been seen in Africa too, but the ones in Africa are barely 3 meters tall. At their tallest, the Nipkas in Iran are 10 meters tall. Normally, Nipkas grow on flat surfaces. They best grow on moist land. The shape of the Nipka depends on the size, density, and growth rate of the host plant. In this Nipka forest, the dominant species is the salt cedar. My goodness, it looks more like a miracle. Just look how God instilled the hope for life in these salt cedars and saxols. When they're just small seedlings, winds dump massive amounts of sand onto them. But driven by their strong will to live, they continue to grow in order to survive. The battle between the wind and sand on one hand and these trees on the other has been going on forever. It's been around for millions of years. But what is really very important is that hope keeps everything and everyone alive. And these trees, because of their intrinsic sense of hope, the will for life, put their roots down and stand tall. They continue to grow as a means of survival. It's going to become stormy very soon. Desert storms are very dangerous. So what you need to do is find shelter somewhere or leave that area immediately. Fortunately, I'm very close to my next destination, and I think I'm not going to run into any trouble. But I have to get going immediately, or I'm going to get sand and dirt all over my body and stuff. My camera crew and I were taken off guard by the sudden change of weather and the subsequent sandstorm. One of the biggest powers of nature in a desert is the ability of sand and dust to penetrate each and every orifice during a storm, and our equipment was no exception. Sandstorms are among the biggest dangers of a desert. In some cases, such storms continue to blow for days and can cost nature travelers their lives. But there are other dangers lurking in other parts of this vast plain. Therefore, the best way to ensure a safe trip to Lut is to make the necessary arrangements with the relevant authorities in Kerman province and the city of Shahdad. From Shahdad, I had to walk around 250 kilometers to the west of the province, to a place only 15 kilometers away from Rafsanjan. Kerman is a province with limited water resources. Many of the deep wells in the province have dried up. But deep in the heart of Rafsanjan's crisis-hit nature, there is a canyon that sparkles like a diamond. You might be thinking this isn't Iran, that I'm speaking to you from another country. But you're wrong. This is our beloved Iran, and I'm now standing atop a scary deep canyon, the Raga Grand Canyon of Rafsanjan. Valleys and canyons are strange yet beautiful natural phenomena, and they become even more beautiful if their emergence is not the result of orogeny, rather if it's the result of thousands or millions of years of erosion by wind, sand, and water of flat plains. Raga Grand Canyon is one such ravine, a peerless, pristine valley in Kerman province. I was amazed at the view of the canyon from above. The pointed cones, the big and small columns carved out by erosion, the arcs, the partitions and wall-like strips were only a few of all the beautiful features of this canyon. Raga is around 20 kilometers long. Its width varies between 3 and 100 kilometers, and in some places it is around 80 meters deep. Walking on top of it could have been very dangerous. My goodness, it's really scary, but it's magnificent at the same time. At this point, I think it's around 70 meters deep from where I'm standing. If I fall into it, there will be nothing left of me. It's dangerous to be here because the earth here is very soft and can slide at any moment. So you'll have to keep a safe distance while walking along these beautiful walls. It's ruggedly beautiful indeed. You can get the most beautiful view of the canyon from up here, but every side of it offers its own unique beauty. What I'm really happy about is the fact that there is no construction work happening anywhere in a 20-kilometer radius. There are no roads. That's why this ravine has maintained its pristine status, and of course, the area around it too. My hope is that we can preserve this untouched ravine and its surroundings the way they are and leave them to the next generation, and they to the generation that comes after them, just like the way it looks now. I hope so. The canyon's geomorphology and its pristine environs made for beautiful scenery, and that had provided a good habitat for certain species of animals in and around it. This region and this gorge are so intact, they've become home to various species of birds, such as eagles that have built their nests in recesses high on the walls where they feel safe. I'm very excited and counting every minute for the walk on the bed of the canyon, but the best time to do it would be tomorrow because I don't have enough time for it today. Rocky Canyon is a good destination for geologists and nature travelers venturing into the Lute. The vegetation, such as salt cedar trees in some parts of the canyon, made the canyon even more beautiful. From the bottom up, ravines look just as beautiful. I walked along much of Rocky Canyon from above and captured many beautiful views of it, but it was now time to go down to the bottom of it. This part of the wall is solid. It's hard to walk on. It's very steep too, as you can see. You have to take a lot of care going down. My God, yes! At the bottom, the canyon was beautiful and scary. I kept thinking its walls were going to come crashing down any minute. Walking at the foot of those majestic walls, I felt how little and weak I was compared to the canyon and to its creator. On one hand, the beautiful long natural statues, and on the other, the tunnel-shaped arcs carved into the walls were all astonishing. Statues chiseled by gravity pulling down the dirt and pebbles on the walls of the ravine.
The view down here is simply breathtaking. The huge, majestic statues carved out on the walls of the canyon have taken thousands of years to be made. As loose earth from the top of the canyon cascaded down to the bottom over the years, it created these beautiful shapes on these walls. They are stunning. Some of them look like humans, and others like certain animals. This canyon is just as beautiful down on its bed as it is from above. This dry tree over here, in fact, there are many others scattered across the ravine. Floodwaters on the highlands and on the plains sweep them up along with some of the trees that grow at the mouth of the canyon in spring and dump them over here. It's a bizarre scene here. It's very dangerous to come here in the spring season because floodwaters are deadly. Ravine exploration is among the most interesting fields in nature traveling. There are many adventurers around the world who are in love with exploring valleys and canyons. But this field of sport comes with its own hidden dangers. The collapse of the walls or falling from the edge of a canyon's walls are among those dangers. But there's another more serious threat to the life of nature travelers, which is seasonal floodwaters caused by rainfall. Just take a look at what seasonal rivers have done to these walls. The water can be around 2 meters deep here at the time of a flood and can be fatal. Whenever I travel to a place like this, I study up on its weather and climate before I set out so I won't run into any trouble. So when it's raining, you better not be anywhere near the bottom of any ravine. Although Raga Canyon is very wide and the floodwaters flowing in pose a less serious threat, it is likely for torrential rain to come down in the nearby areas. And that means flash floods at a certain time during a day or night or a whole day. So at a time like that, you better not come here. Most nature travelers take all kinds of precautions prior to their adventure. But most of them don't pay much attention to the climate of the places they travel to. They don't take the weather forecasts very seriously. In 2005, 11 mountaineers from Ghazvin, with all their equipment and years of experience, entered Andres Canyon in Alborz province. But because they had ignored the weather forecast and the predicted rain, they had an accident. During rainfalls, valleys and canyons that offer no escapes are the most dangerous places in the natural world to be. In that year, heavy rain set off floodwaters in Andres Canyon, and unfortunately, it took the lives of all 11 mountaineers. Therefore, the most important thing that natural explorers should take into account is the weather forecast, the difficulty of the route they're traveling on, and their mental and physical strength for the trip ahead. You can't put a price tag on the environment. All those who walk into nature speak of it as a cathartic experience and absorb massive amounts of positive energy. In my opinion, because the natural world is a manifestation of the greatness and beauty of God, I have walked a very long distance. I'm about to arrive at the end of the canyon. I'm going to have to get out of it before dark sets in, concluding another leg of my trip.
It's very easy to pollute your environment, but that's not right. It only goes to show how irresponsible we humans can be. We have to take responsibility for the environment in our country and in the entire planet. We mustn't dump our garbage out in the open and instead send it to the recycling system. We must treat nature the same way we do our homes. Only then can we say we are committed to other humans, to the planet Earth, and to future generations. I'm approaching the end of my trip. I have no doubt that many of my countrymen and women are not familiar with the beautiful natural wonders of Kerman province. And many of the officials in the province don't seem to be aware of the great potential these natural wonders have as tourist destinations. In addition to its old history and culture, the province boasts unique natural features on a par with their counterparts in the rest of the world. In the developed world, development doesn't include building roads, hotels, and tourism centers in the heart of the environment. In the century we live in, development and progress is tantamount to the unconditional and responsible preservation of the environment, and sustainable development of the tourism industry can easily set in motion the big wheels of the country's economy. The environment in Iran is very fragile and sensitive, but with proper professional preservation and protection, by people and officials alike, it can turn into a big generator of jobs and revenues, provided that we appreciate what we have and do all we can to preserve what's left of Iran's untapped natural world. We should perish the thought of construction on it.
I'm sure you'll agree with me that Iran's deserts, with their varied and dramatic landscapes of canyons, yardangs, and their beautiful flora and fauna, are a unique destination for the demanding traveler to discover a wealth of exceptional and unspoiled views. And that's it for this week. Do keep in touch with us, and until next week, goodbye.
Stories from the Past. Stories from the lives of the infallibles. Stories from different parts of the world. On the Lantern.
Bismillah ar-Rahman ar-Rahim. Assalamu alaikum wa rahmatullah. Dear listeners, thank you so very much for joining us on today's brand new episode of The Lantern. I don't know what the reason is. And it's so much so that we constantly come across memes and jokes and reels and whatever about this topic on social media. And I'm somehow glad that it's more openly talked about in a very lighthearted sort of quality. Maybe it will raise more awareness in the next generation, because the past generation is a lost cause to a certain degree. But in certain cultures, the amount of toxic talk down children receive from their parents is just ridiculous. I am in no position to tell parents how to raise their kids or tell cultures how to culture. But again, just from personal experience, when I compare the different families that I see around me from different backgrounds, and the way the parents and the children interact with each other, the words that are used. God, words are so, so, so important. The way we talk to each other, our choice of words, sometimes even the tone we use. And I'm just telling this to remind myself, because I can be so salty and so sassy sometimes in the way I speak. And I go back and I think about it in my head, and I was like, dang, I was such a jerk. And so many ahadith and riwayat and ayat warn us about this matter. Let's listen to a story about this, about choice of words and the impact they have on other human beings. And we'll be right back.
Bismillah ar-Rahman ar-Rahim, in the name of Allah, the most compassionate, the most merciful, dear brothers and sisters, salamun alaikum. So welcome to this episode of Lantern, Wranglers and Strangers is the title of today's story. Many years ago, there were a group of brilliant young men at the University of Wisconsin. The group of men seemed to have an amazing creative literary talent and were extraordinary in their ability to put their literary skills to its best use. These promising young men met regularly to read and critique each other's literary works. These men were merciless while they criticized one another. They accepted the most minute of the expressions and offered tough and even mean criticism to each other's work. These meeting sessions became arenas of literary criticism, and the members of this exclusive club called themselves the Strangers, not to be excluded to the opportunity to level up their literary skills. Women of the literary interest in the university started a club of their own, one comparable to Stranglers. The members called themselves the Wranglers. The member of the loop, too, presented their literary pieces in front of each other, but the feedback from members were much more softer, more pathetic, and more encouraging. Every effort from a member, even the more feeble one, was encouraged by all. After 20 years, a university alumnus was doing a study of his classmates' career when he noticed the huge difference in the literary accomplishments of the Stranglers and the Wranglers. Among all the brilliant young men in the Stranglers, none had made any significant literary achievement, but the Wranglers have several successful writers and some renowned national literary talents. The talent and the education between the two groups were almost the same. The Stranglers strangled each other while the Wranglers gave each other a lift. The Stranglers created an atmosphere of contention and self-doubt, while the Wranglers brought out the best in each other. The greatest success we'll know is helping others succeed and grow. That was the famous quote by Georgie Scott Reid.
The Lantern.
Under the light of lantern, we'll look at the story which indicates a moral aspects of our life.
I don't know if you guys remember, but a few years back, maybe 10, 20 years back, this Japanese scientist did a little experiment with water molecules, and he wrote encouraging, loving, caring words onto, you know, a sample of water, and he wrote bad, violent, hostile words onto another sample of water, and then he checked the molecules under a microscope after a while, and then he saw that the water that was spoken to nicely and gently, the molecules, well, not the molecule structure itself, but the shape of it, were more harmonized and beautiful, while the water that was abused, you know, verbally abused, became ugly under a microscope. I don't know if you guys remember that. I'm just saying that we're 70%, 65% water, so imagine the effect of words on us. But the human soul is obviously more conscious and intelligent than water molecules. And we pick up the smallest frequencies and radiations in a person's words, especially as children. Their souls are so pristine and their minds are so clear that the smallest gesture, we think that, oh, they're just kids, you know, they just let it slide. They don't remember, but no. They're so impressionable, and their souls, because it's so fresh, we leave prints on it without realizing. Now they're happy, bubbly, perky, chirpy little kids because they don't have to pay bills or turn in theses or pay mortgage. But once the going gets tough, they will reveal all that stuff that was boiling up on the inside, all those internal prints we left on them. And then, you know, the end result is this really bitter, depressed, insecure society with the confidence level of a turnip. There's a hadith from Amir al-Mu'mineen Ali alayhi salam, and I feel that I understand this hadith, the gravity of this hadith, the older I get, that says the human tongue is like a wild animal. It's a sabu', and if you let it loose, it will devour and shred people apart. And I've seen so many people who have zero control over their tongues, and they literally just say whatever the heck it is that's on their mind, and not necessarily in a bluntly honest, awkwardly cute sort of Luna Lovegood kind of way. It's savage, and it's just downright rude and impolite. And it is so important. One of the ways of training the nafs and the ego is for us to have control over our tongues and to have higher awareness and mindfulness regarding the words we choose, our vernacular, our vocabulary, and the tone in which we say certain things to certain people. And of course, there's the hadith that really keeps you safe, where it says, if you don't have anything good or useful to say, just stay quiet. Or the other hadith from Amir al-Mu'mineen Ali alayhi salam that says, إِذَا تَمَّ الْعَغْنَ غَسْلَ الْكَلَامِ, when the intellect becomes complete, the words are shortened. In other words, when you're smarter, you talk less. What does that say about me and my career, really? I get paid to talk. It's horrible. Anyway, the point is, please be careful of the things you say. I'm saying this mostly to myself. It's really, really, really important to think before we speak, because the consequences of those words are dire, are so profound for us and for the person who's at the receiving end. And we will only realize it when it's too late, unfortunately. Thank you for being with us. Wassalamu alaikum wa rahmatullah.
That was all for today. Thank you very much for joining us. Inshallah, we continue this topic on the next episode. Till then, may Allah bless all of you. Fi amanillah. أنا بذكر الله تطمئن القلوب.
This is IRIB English Radio. Coming up is the news.